Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
We're live today. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wipr.org. And we weren't here last week.
No, because...
we had a previously recorded program. That was
well,
on.
Yeah, we were open for Mama's Day.
Which is... We will never be live on Mother's Day.
Yeah, we will never be live on Mom's Day because we need to feed a lot of moms. That was fun. I love that day. It's always fun too to be for us to be open in the daytime.
It's the Olympics of the restaurant business.
Oh my gosh, that was an interesting weekend. We had that we had a really big food event dinner on Saturday night, and Friday was super busy. So it was an exciting weekend, very fun. Right, Tony?
Fun is one of those words you could use.
It's a lot of work is what it was.
When
but
you describe
yes.
something fun, yes.
It was a lot of work on everyone's part and everybody.
So we've been accumulating questions from people as we speak with them, guests.
Mm-hmm.
And we get emails from time to time on several common topics. So we wanted to take some time today and answer some of those questions as simply and concisely as at least we're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
You can reach us if you have some of those questions about food or wine. 410-662-8780, or send via email, foremanwolf@wipr.org. So,
yeah, I think there's some pretty consistent questions that we get asked, too.
I had one, three questions the exact same at market this morning.
Oh, wow. What was it?
So I just paid $5 a pound for this asparagus. How do I keep from ruining it?
Oh, gosh. Yeah, right. That's a lot of money.
I mean, there's several excellent. I mean, that. Especially if you're getting from the Eastern Shore, you're getting some of the best asparagus
in
the world.
It's so, so good. I think, you know, one of the biggest things with asparagus is it's any time you cook a green vegetable, you need a large pot of water versus, you know, the quantity of product, because the biggest aspect of cooking a green vegetable is that you need the boil to recover as soon as possible once you add the product.
So I'm going to play devil's advocate. I don't have a giant pot, and I have to do asparagus for 8 people.
Oh, gosh. Well, you're going to need to go buy one then.
Or you can do it in batches.
Well, yeah. I'd go buy a big pot, personally. But, yes.
Of course you would.
You know, if you're going to do it in batches, that's fine. So the thing with asparagus is, you want to trim it before you cook it, which is going to reduce the size, which will make it easier to find a pot that it'll fit in. You want to snap it at the point where it's least resistance and sort of just, you know, we usually, you know, if I were to say, I'd say we probably cut it about 20% of the end off. And you know, and each piece is different from the other. So you have the luxury of doing for 8 people versus us doing it for maybe 50 people. So you can actually snap each one.
So and then, to peel or not to peel?
And that's up to you. I mean, there's a lot of vitamins in that outside, but the outside of the asparagus, but I prefer to peel it. I think it's nicer to eat that way. It's a little more tender when you peel it. And two, it's really pretty. You know, it looks nice. Yes.
You say that because a French chef was very upset with you one time for not peeling your
asparagus.
Yeah,
I think I just recently told that story, but I'll say it very quickly, which was Jean-Louis Pelladin, who is an incredible chef in the country, in our country from France, came into, we had a restaurant called Savannah at the time.
Just some
years ago. Yeah, a long time ago. And he was in and he just off the cuff asked for some fresh asparagus, and I sent it out, and he sent it immediately back to me because I hadn't peeled it. It was one of the more embarrassing moments of my life. And honestly, I'd never been taught to peel asparagus, and didn't realize it was really that necessary. And to him it was. Now, I will also
I always follow the skinny and fat rule.
Yeah, well, sure.
If it's skinny,
really
you don't
tiny,
need to.
Yeah, if it's really tiny, do not, because you'll end up with nothing. But yeah, if it's pretty small, you know, pencil like, which is standard. That's what that size is called. Yeah, you really don't need to peel it. But as it gets bigger, you do I really do think you should peel it. But the other thing is, you know, again, with as I said, you want a pot that has a good amount of water. It needs to be rolling boil when you go in with your product. You need to have your ice water ready to go on the side. So we call it an ice bath or shocking water. So a good amount of ice with some water in it. And then as you are, you know, blanching your product, you want a nice amount of salt in there. I think Thomas Keller says is salty as the sea. And I think that's a great reference. if you can handle salt like that, and then blanch it and until it's just al dente, and then shock it immediately. And then, yeah, you can do it in batches. And I usually use tongs to get it in and
out. How long does it take? That was the question.
Well, I think that's, you know, it depends on how big it is. So I would say anywhere from just under a minute to 2 minutes.
As soon as the color is really bright, get it out of there.
Yeah,
just at that moment. Just at that moment.
Yeah, once you see the color come up and it's dark green, you know you're typically on the right path. But you can always just pull one out and eat it, and see if it's the way that you like it. And the more you cook it,
please do not reach into the boiling water. Cindy is much tougher than the rest of us.
But yeah, that's how you cook asparagus. And then now you're ready to do whatever. You know, maybe you're getting ready to eat it. So then obviously you don't need to shock it. You just boil it and then toss it in a pan with olive oil or some sort of neutral oil. Or if you were me, you would toss it in butter with salt.
So probably the worst thing to drink in the entire world with asparagus to me is Pinot Noir from the West Coast.
Mm.
And in the second segment, we have a special treat. We have Eva Dellinger. I don't think you'd like that segue. Eva Dellinger from Dellinger Winery in Sonoma County is going to be with us in the second segment.
That's super cool that she's here.
Yeah, that'll be excellent.
It'll be fun to talk to her.
You can find... you can find information about Dellinger, DellingerWinery.com. Let me spell it for you. Dehlinger Winery.com. And they make spectacular stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is the far and away longest, deepest collection of American Pinot that I have in my own cellar. So
very cool. Yeah, I'm super excited.
I am pleased, so you can line up your wine questions.
And yeah,
What it's like to be growing up in a real family winery.
Yeah.
And let's go to a call with questions from Frank in Mount Washington, please. Hey, Frank, how are you today?
Hi, Frank.
Good morning, Tony. Good morning, Cindy. I have something I'd like each of you to comment on separately. First, Cindy, let me start by saying you're my favorite chef.
Thank you.
I do like some other cooks and how they present. And I recently saw an extended interview heard with Nigella Lawson, and she took great pains to differentiate between the home cook and the chef, mm-hmm. and how different their mission is and their ways are. Number one, do you agree? And number two, if you could reinforce that, because I think it's so important for people to understand that when they're entertaining guests, they're not being chefs in their own kitchen. And then, Tony, for you, I wonder if you could comment on the real need for some sort of a pathway for the general public to educate their palate about wine tasting so that then they can make these choices and understand what people in the know like you are telling them, and they can anticipate those sensations and therefore just be more knowledgeable wine connoisseurs.
Well, thanks, Frank.
Yeah, great.
Your questions are always good.
Thank you so much, Frank.
So, ladies first.
All right. You know, it's for me, the difference between a home chef and a professional chef is that the work aspect isn't there when you're cooking at home. To me, I mean, for me, when I get to cook at home, I'm so happy. It's such a joy. I'm not under any kind of pressure.
It doesn't matter when it goes on the table.
Yeah, exactly. There's no timing. I don't have to worry about anything. And one of my favorite things to do at home is to grill outside. And it's just such a joy for me because I've been cooking for many, many years inside. And
you never grill at work either.
I've always worked the saute station. Yeah, our kitchen is divided into three distinct stations. And it's actually a physical barrier between the two stations. So because we have a center cooking battery. But yeah, I love to grill outside. And I think it always reminds me every single time I stand outside. And what I was getting at was I've cooked in a lot of basement kitchens, and I love the outdoors, and it's really hard for me to be in a space without any windows. And so just to be able to actually literally stand outside and cook is just so joyful for me. And I just, you know, so I don't have a stove outside. So the only way I can cook outside is on a grill. And, ooh, that's an idea.
Oh,
wouldn't
good
that
Lord.
Be cool? Have a stove outside? Oh,
yeah,
that
please,
would be fun.
Please get a white one.
Oh, yeah, white one. And and yeah, so for me, that is the biggest difference between cooking at home and cooking professionally. I will say about cooking at home that I work very, very hard to make my kitchen be as similar to my work kitchen. That is my greatest frustration with cooking in a home, is that I want all the same tools. I wish I had all the same equipment. And of course, I can't have that. But I really try to set up my home kitchen as similarly as I do to my work kitchen.
So my kitchen at home, once upon a time, it was just me in the house. There was nothing in there besides things I was going to cook or tools to get it done with.
Mm-hmm.
And life happens in there now. their toys.
You mean you have two children
yeah,
and a wife? Yeah.
I mean, their toys, okay. There's stuff everywhere. It is unending.
Oh.
There are three different color paints on the kitchen table. You know, and
that's joyful too.
That has to be. I mean, life is happening in your house.
That's nice.
It's not just you making the food.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very.
It is in your house.
I mean, that's the thing that occurs to
so
me.
So that's not happening in mine. So that's a big difference too. What you're pointing
out
is. But
thinking about the home cook entertaining, I'm just thinking, oh my gosh.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people have so much that the kitchen's often like the central living space for an awful lot of people.
Yeah, so. Not having a kitchen for the last like 4 months. I mean, it really hits home how important your kitchen is.
Answering
to your home.
Answering Frank's wine question about educating oneself. Tasting is the most important thing. One thing I always stress to guests and the staff, whenever you get a chance to taste more than one thing at the same time, in the same conditions,
mm-hmm.
where the wines might have any kind of similarity or relationship, really. Maybe they're two wines from totally different places in the world, the same vintage. Maybe the same grape grown in two different places. Maybe the same winery, same vineyard site, same varietal of varietals, but in different years.
I love that so much. It's the best way to learn.
Those are the ways that those exercises, I mean, really it's what it is. It's exercises for your palate.
Mm-hmm.
That requires usually, since not everyone thinks of wine bottles as single serving bottles, but maybe our guest will, but we'll ask her. That usually requires having people to share that with. And you know what? That conversation that you have, that experience, that learning to use those muscles, use those senses, is really important. It's like having a study buddy in school, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of that common experience.
Discovery.
And having someone either validate what mm-hmm. you're saying or be a good enough friend to correct you. No, that doesn't smell like licorice at all. You're just not, you're not on that.
The discovery is so fun. You know, it's just, it's
and go,
and
go
the more
to,
you taste, the more you discover.
Take classes. I mean, there are classes.
Mm-hmm.
Take classes, but really it's tasting is 98% of it. And then when you've tasted, then you have an experience to draw on, go look something up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't look up what it's supposed to taste like. Actually taste it and then go look it up.
Yeah, that's fun.
You know,
I like
it's
that.
Like having the answers for your homework before you do your homework. It doesn't.
Well,
it's not going to help you.
And you do blind tastings at work with the servers. And I love that. I think that's so much fun, too, because when you really have literally no idea or no preconceived idea about what's in the bottle, I think that's such an awakening experience, you know, and I'm totally, I so love what you said about, you know, tasting the two similar, you know, same varietal or same years or all of the above, or even doing a flight of the same house from year to year. Oh, I love that. It's just so fascinating, and it is the best way to learn.
The other thing, one of the worst ways to learn is if you drink wine like it's a sport, like you're trying to win it, you're not going to learn that much.
Wait a minute. What do you mean by that? Like,
I mean,
by drinking a lot of it?
Tasting and drinking are two different things.
Okay, yeah, you mean drinking a lot. Well, yes, that's not. Yeah.
You recall and you used to be faculties are not going to be that great. Your analysis may not be valid, let's say.
Well, yeah, and I mean, you can spit. So, I mean, you know, you don't have to consume, especially if you're really trying to learn. You don't want to really consume.
So we're live on Formula Wolf on Food & Wine today. You can reach us with Food & Wine questions. Give us a ring, 410-662-8780, or email us, formanwolf@wypr.org. And coming up in just a moment, we have Eva Dellinger from Dellinger Winery. You can look it up, dellingerwinery.com. And we'll be back on WYPR in just a moment. Welcome back to Formula Wolf on Food & Wine. We're live today taking your food and wine questions. You can reach us 410-662-8780. And I didn't even say...
Who we are.
We are, yeah. I'm Tony Foreman.
And I'm Cindy Wolf.
And
they know who we are.
They pretty much know who we are.
It's more exciting that we have a new person with us in the studio.
We have a guest whose name I've been mispronouncing for, I don't know, 8 years or something like that, then it's Eva Dellinger.
That's me, Eva Dellinger.
Thanks for being here, Eva.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
It's cool that you popped up in Baltimore.
Yeah. Came in and ate dinner last night. I like that.
It was, it did not disappoint.
Wine people, thank you very
much. And then strong-armed her into coming on the program.
My pleasure.
So let's give a quick little history of the winery you grew up in.
I'm a second-generation winemaker, so I really did grow up in the business. It's a small family-owned estate winery in California, in Sonoma County's Russian River Valley.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I'm actually the youngest of four, work with my sister Carmen. We're the two siblings who have joined the company, and this is what we do. I'm the general manager. I make the wine, and I oversee our vineyards.
That's great. How much land do you have?
We are now at 80 acres in vine. It's all
amazing.
Contiguous, so it's a place. It's is an estate all there together.
How long did it take to get all those 80 acres? I bet that took some time.
It was sort of a manifest destiny over the past 40 years.
Wow.
My dad got started in 1975, and we've slowly been adding parcels.
That's great. Good for you. That's a lot of land.
So since when you were a kid, what's the first thing that you noticed? I mean, were you tasting or did your dad give you wine to drink?
When you were
a
little
kid?
Yes. Although the interesting thing about children, of course, is that they have very sensitive palates. So the alcohol, the acidity, the tannins are very aggressive. And so you notice as people mature, their attraction to wine is enhanced. And that was the case for me.
Yeah, I have a 5-year-old who will definitely just stick her tongue out of her mouth when you make her taste something.
Well, they're so sensitive.
She loves
That's
the
interesting.
She
didn't realize that.
She loves the smells of it.
Mm-hmm.
She's very good at naming a lot of things that she smells. You know, that's like mushrooms, Daddy. That's like cherries. That's like lemon.
Try Sauternes. That might be a hit.
There you go.
Oh, yeah.
Sweet wine.
Yeah, yeah. So that's, I'm not always opening bottles of Sauternes. So what is your favorite wine that you guys have ever made?
Ooh, favorite wine that we've ever made.
And maybe give us an idea of the range of things that you all are producing.
We grow four varieties. We grow Pinot Noir. We're pretty well known for our Pinot Noir and our Chardonnay. We also grow Cabernet, which is relatively rare for the Russian River Valley, being a cooler region. And we grow Syrah. And Syrah is one of my very favorite varieties, and One of my very favorite wines that we've ever made was our 2005 East Face Syrah, which is from a particular section of our three-acre Syrah vineyard. Mm-hmm. And it just captures what is so special about the Russian River Valley, and that the variety ripens there. It has enough oomph to be welcoming and generous, but it's cool enough that you get a variety of aromas. You get tapenade, you get bacon, and I get that in that particular wine.
Hmm. And that's still drinking well.
Oh yes, Syrah's a great ager.
Yeah, that's I've always, like I said, I keep many vintages of Pinot from you all, and we have a number of vintages, I'm sure you saw, of Syrah in the cellar from you. But the wines are very individual and very particular and have a lot of personality, and that's the thing that I appreciate, because frankly I love Coca-Cola, and it's the same every time, but it's just not that interesting every time. It doesn't have its own, and it doesn't develop particular personality. Wine is the beverage that does, and you can have a dynamic relationship with it, and you can have that relationship with a particular wine over time.
Right. It's got that ephemeral quality to it.
I just described it like the loneliest guy in the world.
So, what's the soil like there?
It's sedimentary. Sorry. We're pretty close to the Pacific Ocean, and the soil reflects that. We have two soil types, one which is very sandy, much like the sand near the ocean, although, of course, consolidated over time. And on the hilltops, we have another sedimentary soil called Altamont, which has a higher clay content.
Okay. So what are you growing where? What are the conditions you're looking for the four varietals, where you think it shows up best?
The Pinot Noir expresses itself very well in both varieties, and in both soil types. And for that reason, we actually make soil-designate wines from our two soils. The Chardonnay does very well in the Goldridge soil, which is the sandier soil. And the Cabernet does very well in the clay soil, which is the Altamont soil.
When you're blending or when you're putting a vintage together, what do you think about? What goes through your head when you're making final decisions about what you want from the wine? What's your inspiration, sort of, if you will? And I know there are a lot of them, I'm sure. But
there are. Part of it is, in fact, the soil, that we want the expression of the land to come through. And for that reason, we're separating out the different fermentations from different portions of our vineyard. And so that is paramount, is keeping that, preserving that. Beyond that, we're looking for special gems. Sometimes we'll take our very, very best lot and we'll bottle it separately just to highlight it.
Sure.
Yeah, you all have definitely done a lot of little one-offs. What was it? Was it a Zin Petit Syrah blend in 2009?
Yes, yeah. That was one of
That was crazy stuff.
Yeah.
I think your dad told me that he got fruit from a neighbor.
Yes, that was one of our rare non-estate bottlings. Hmm. It was a fun side project. That was Zinfandel and Petit Syrah from Dry Creek, from older vines, the Zinfandel.
That was a beast. It was delicious.
Yes. There's a lot of very good Zinfandel in Sonoma and in the Russian River Valley.
That is definitely the place where Far and Away gets its most interesting voice.
Mm-hmm. How has Sonoma changed since you've grown up? I haven't been there in a long time, and I know it's very different.
It has changed. It's gotten more recognition. You see more of an influence from the Bay Area. There's more people. It has built up more touristically, and that's a double-edged sword. Some people miss the complete ruralness of when I was growing up, but I have to say I enjoy the transformation on the restaurant scene. There's now a lot of really good culinary destinations, particularly in Hillsburg, that's now quite happening. When I was growing up, it was more of a cow town.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First visits out there for me, definitely. It's pretty relaxed, pretty backward, and I don't know if the biggest crop was wine for a number of those years.
Well, we still have all of that to this day.
Mm-hmm. What are some of your favorite restaurants?
Ooh, A super classic restaurant is the Underwood that's in Grayton, actually. And that is that's the winemaker hangout.
Oh,
Underwood
that's
Bar
cool.
and Bistro. So
that's
next
good
time
to know.
You're in town,
I'll go there.
Go check it out.
Cool.
That's funny. The Helen Turley sent me there probably 20 years ago.
Hmm. It's still a popular place.
That's awesome. Have you worked in preparation for what you're doing? Have you worked at all in other places in the country or out of the country?
I had the opportunity to work a little bit in New Zealand, Australia, and I studied for a year in Burgundy, and I did a stage there. That's the great thing about wine is it's so global, and there are a lot of special areas in the world where winemakers go either to work or visit and discover the wine culture there.
Mm. So yeah, you speak
it's
French?
Always been
I do.
Yeah, good for you.
It's always been a very free-flowing community.
It is.
It's an interesting thing. Maybe that can transfer over into some other places in our lives. Mm. Favorite wine you ever had?
Favorite wine I ever had. It's interesting.
It's the worst question, but I'm going to ask it anyway.
I appreciate that you asked it because we're talking today about questions that we get, and that's a very, very common one. And what's the answer? The wine that's in my hand is the wine that I had last.
Yeah, I often say the 365 days of the year, they're all different days.
Right.
You feel differently on different days.
What's the favorite wine you've ever had?
That's tough. I can definitely make a pretty good list. 76 Salon is somewhere near the top, and a great champagne producer that I've been lucky enough to have a couple of times and has always been magnificent. And another champagne, 52 Gosse, has been great. But sometimes the things that you get, like, I get completely excited about some stupid Barbera from last year that shows up, and I've known the winemaker, like Franco Masolino in Sedalonga d'Alba. I've known him for years, and his Barbera has always been good, but all of a sudden in 16, it's terrific, and it's no money, and it's like I want to put a bottle in everyone's kitchen, like.
Do you think your relationship with the producer colors your enjoyment of the wine or how well you know a person?
No, I'm a difficult person. I'm critical of everybody. So if I know them, I'm probably tougher on them, honestly. Especially because maybe I was attracted to their best work at some point, but because I have a relationship, I'm going to look at it critically because I actually care about what they're doing. If it was someone that I don't know, it's much easier to just dismiss it. Especially if I don't have belief that they're capable of excellent work, So I told you I'm difficult.
What do you think you got, some of the things you got from being in Burgundy? It's such an amazing wine region. What did you pick up?
What I loved about Burgundy was how pervasive the wine culture was. In America, there's obviously been a huge transformation in terms of appreciation of wine, and it's more and more part of our culture. But it remains maybe the interest of a certain segment of the population. Whereas when I was in Burgundy, it was everybody. It was everybody was in wine, loved wine, appreciated wine, studied wine. It was like a dream come true.
Mm-hmm. Well, wine is almost like its own language. And if everyone's practicing speaking it all the time, then when you say, it's a 2004 Moray Saint-Denis, your face becomes a disappointed face because the odds of you running into something that's really remarkable, from Moray Saint-Denis in 2004, maybe not so great, Or if you pull a cork on a Clos de Tarn and it's corked, the first you cry. But everyone else who speaks that language, they can empathize, yeah.
Yeah.
So, are you a good cook?
I'm a reasonably good cook.
So, what is the best food and wine pairing you've ever made of a wine that you made and food that you made? That's a lot of control.
Yeah. Well, the wine, that part is easy. The wine is easy. What comes to mind to me is Thanksgiving meals, turkey with Pinot Noir, Chardonnay. That's just such a classic. Although it's obviously colored by being with family and spending time drinking the wine that you've made with, obviously, my family with whom I work very closely.
We have an excellent, important question from Ronnie in Baltimore. What has your experience been as a woman winemaker? Has it been at all like some other industries who have a history of being a boys' club? Do you feel like you've had to work extra hard to prove yourself, or has it been fairly accepting?
That's a very interesting question. Traditionally, winemaking has been male-dominated. A lot has changed over the last 30 years. There's a lot of very important female winemakers who came before me, and that's a real privilege to have had the ground broken, so to speak. So one thing you see in wine is there are a number of very high-level female winemakers who get a huge amount of respect, and so it is less and less unusual to see a woman winemaker. And so I've always tried to bring another dimension to my work, having the experience of being maybe a bit of an outsider in that sense, but it's one that people can accept, and it is one where you can essentially bring another perspective and another dimension.
Excellent. We're coming up on a break. Do you want to stay with us for a few minutes?
I'd love to.
That's great.
Good.
When we come back, we're still happy to take your questions, 410-662-8780, or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org, and we'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
See, I remembered to introduce us this time. We're live, quite clearly. You can reach us 410-662-8780 or email us foremanwolf@wypr.org. And we're doing questions that we commonly get. Mm-hmm. And we also have with us a special guest, Eva Dehlinger. Who's the general manager and winemaker at Dehlinger Winery, one of my personal favorites in the New World. And so what kind of questions do you always get?
I get a lot of repeat questions. And I think part of it is that fewer and fewer Americans are involved in agriculture. So there's an intrigue and a mystery about what it's like to be in agriculture.
Hard.
Yes.
Yes.
Hard but engaging. Mm-hmm. It's engaging, and you get to be outside, and you get to know what you're doing, right? You know what you're doing for a living. The results are very clear. It's very concrete. One question I get a lot is, and they're always very difficult to answer. One question I get a lot is, what is your typical day like? And yeah. They're never
That's
the
funny,
same.
That's funny because we get the same question.
I hadn't thought of that question, but yes.
Like, if by the time I wrote you a schedule for what the day would be over. Don't even.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, each day is different for us.
Yeah, each day is different.
Is it for you?
Right,
yeah.
And there's the weather component, and in my line of work, there's the viticultural work, and there's also the winemaking work. So it's very varied. That's a question that I get. People want to know a lot of details about me. They want to know when I get up in the morning.
Oh,
that interests people, agriculture.
That may not be about wine.
Yeah. what wines I'm drinking lately, what other producers I recommend.
So what wines are you drinking lately?
Yeah, you have to answer some of these questions.
Okay, yeah, some of the questions. Well, I always love drinking wines from, well, certainly there's a joy in drinking wines from all over the world, but I always love drinking wines from where I'm from, because when you've seen the location and you've met the people, it brings another dimension to the experience. Mm-hmm. And so those remain my favorite wines, is the wines from my region, not only because they're delicious, but because I know the people and I know the stories.
Mm-hmm. And probably bad politics to not say that. So that's, we have an email from a regular emailer, Willis and Waverly. I've never been to wine country before. What is the big difference between Napa and Sonoma in terms of wineries, wines made, vibe? Can you do both regions in one trip? Do you need to make appointments?
What great questions. Napa and Sonoma are different. We're different culturally. One big difference is that Napa is really associated in particular with one grape variety, which is Cabernet Sauvignon. Clearly, there's many varieties made in Napa, but that's the big association. And so you get, when you visit Napa, you get a really big focus on Cab. Whereas Sonoma is more diverse. There's not only more varieties produced, but there's more agriculture. So there's, in fact, there's apples, there's a burgeoning cider scene, there's beer, there's flower farms. So you get a more diverse experience. It's a pretty big region, Sonoma. So if I were you, I would go on a trip just to Sonoma and enjoy it and see all that it has to offer. If you go to both regions, make sure you give yourself enough time. The worst mistake you could make is to try to do both in one day.
Oh.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, no way.
That's just too much driving, first off.
Right.
Yeah.
That's another good question from a listener, Susie in Pikesville. It sounds like your winemaking passion and profession was passed down to you from your father. Have you found yourself trying to carry on his process and legacy, or do you look for ways you can break off and chart your own winemaking path?
What a great question. Wine is very traditionally multi-generational. Obviously, we have a shorter history in the United States of family-owned wineries, but if you look to other regions, it's a classic.
Yeah, I know grower in Cahors that from 1100, then Geoffroy has been on the same property. Charlemagne was in power.
Wow.
When
mm-hmm.
they started farming that site.
Right. So there's these links in the chain, and in that case, it's an unbroken link for many, many generations. And it's something that builds. So I have incredible leverage in that I was able to learn from someone who had already spent 30 years at that time, you know, now 40 plus. And so that gives you essentially another life to build on. But it is a building process. So it's always a process of deepening and going further and improving not only the wine, but the company. That's been a big focus for my sister Carmen and I, is looking at different ways we can improve the organization, develop our staff. There's always more to do and learn.
Yeah, definitely. How many staff do you have?
In the vineyard, we are we're about 10, depending on the time of year. And then in the winery, we are more or less 4 people.
Very good.
And what's the total production for that small team?
7,000 cases of wine.
Wow. What was the first year you all produced wine?
1975.
75. Okay, that's when you
did. For some reason, I thought you guys had gotten a little bigger than that. That's not that much.
And that's 80 acres. That's
right.
Amazing.
Yes, and in fact, we sell some amount of grapes.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yes.
Right.
So mm-hmm. that's one of my hats is seller of grapes.
Okay. Very good.
Let's take a quick, we have a caller who left a question that we want to get to, because I think, honestly, people mm-hmm. would like to hear it. Susan in Bel Air, how do you get a whole duck's skin crispy in a home convection oven?
It just takes time. I would rub it with salt and pepper and, you know, whatever else you want to season the bird with. But you need temperature and time to get it to be really brown. And one of the other things you can do, it depends on what level of fat there is on the duck, but you could score it a little bit. Don't go too deep, but just score it a little bit, which will release some of the fats, which will sort of self-baste itself, but also baste while you're roasting. And you can always, you know, turn up the temperature near the end of the cooking process, which is what you would do with any bird, quite frankly. You know, start off at 325, and as you get to whatever temperature your goal is, let's say you're looking for the bird to be around medium, you know, the last 15 minutes of cooking, maybe you crank up your oven to 400. And having a convection oven is wonderful because, you know, obviously that means that the air is moving evenly through the oven, and it does help to create a much better environment. And it also depends on your oven. I have a new stove, and I'm anxious to use it because I've had three of these stoves that I'm working with right now in my homes. And the first one that I had, I produced the best roasted chicken I've ever made. And then I bought a different type of that stove with one big oven rather than two small ovens, and it did not produce the same kind of chicken. So it really also depends on your oven. So the better you know your oven, practice on some things that are less expensive than a duck, for example, a chicken, and really try and figure out how you can, you know, what temperature it does really create a good crispy skin, but basting helps a lot.
What do you want to drink with a crispy roasted whole duck?
Oh, definitely a Pinot Noir.
Mm-hmm.
How many items is that going to be your answer?
That's the great thing about Pinot Noir is it's so versatile.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
What would you have with the duck?
Oh, gosh. It really depends on what else is on the dish and if there's a sauce. And mm-hmm. I mean, it gets down to a lot of specifics, you know. I mean, has it been seasoned with something that is not just salt and pepper?
I would do a little bit of rosemary rubbed in. And right now we're getting these gorgeous from a farm in Ohio. We're waiting on our local product to come in. So it hasn't been warm enough to really get much local product other than asparagus and strawberries from Virginia. But we're doing all these beautiful little baby beets. And, you know, some are golden and some are red and some are red and golden. And they're so sweet and so gorgeous. And then all these little different carrots, all different varieties, all different shapes. And just having that and roasting that in, you know, putting that in the pan near the end of the cooking process and letting them sort of wallow around in that fat a little bit, you know, it would be really delicious. Maybe cipollini onions, you know, which have that sort of flowery taste to them and so sweet and beautiful. And then just do some sort of reduction sauce with, I would use some of your wine because I love to cook with good wine.
Yeah, I think to complete that answer, what she's talking about making, if it was Pinot, I would want to drink something that honestly still had some tannin to it because of the fat level of the duck. So, I mean, you guys don't make particularly tannic Pinot Noir, you know, but I can think of the growers in the Jeffrey Chambertin that do. I would drink Syrah with that. From you all, I would be tempted.
Especially with that
with
rosemary.
The preparation.
Yeah.
But that makes me, whether it's like Altamont Syrah or, Saint-Joseph comes to mind also. Bernard Grippa, his Le Berceau bottling.
Grippa.
I
admire you so much for having worked in Burgundy. I think that is brave and incredible. Where did you work when you were in Burgundy? Did you work in more than one place?
I worked at Clos du Tar.
Oh, yeah, golly. Oh. What? Oh, my God.
That corked bottle you mentioned really.
Wow, how lucky are you? Oh, my gosh. That's amazing that you
worked
there.
I opened a bottle of 06 last night.
Okay, how about that?
It corked?
For the guests that were sitting behind you.
And it was corked?
No, it was fantastic.
Oh, golly. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. I love Clos du Tar. That's so cool.
It's a pretty special place for me, given that it's like our family's estate. It's a monopole. So it's all there. It's all together. And in Burgundy, that's particularly rare.
Yeah, there's all kinds of morcellated estates, three rows here and five rows there. And
yeah, I don't know what monopole means. I'm sorry.
It means it's all contiguous and it's all.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's its own
all
appellation.
Together.
That is unusual.
It's its own
okay.
appellation. Clos du Tar is the
that.
Appellation.
That's cool. Oh, my gosh. That is amazing. Very cool.
Like Clos de la Roche is broken up by several different producers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Clos de l'Ambre is its own.
Okay.
So it's monopolized by the one producer.
Got it. Okay. That's neat. Did you live on the estate?
I lived in Beaune, which was
I love Beaune.
Not too far of a drive.
Mm. What's your favorite restaurant in Beaune?
Oh, Ma Cuisine.
Of course,
oh,
that's
absolutely.
Ours.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, there's a little bistro.
Pierre is good too.
Yeah, she's amazing. Well, that's a female chef. She well.
I was talking about Pierre, who is in the front.
Oh, but the lady is a chef, but she isn't there anymore.
She's not there.
That's sad. There's a restaurant, a little bistro that we've gone to. Do you remember the name of that one? Where we get steak tartare and
it's not the same.
Oh, it's not.
Not the same.
Oh,
it's changed.
Ah, okay, never mind.
Sorry about that.
All right.
There's a little family restaurant, Les Ciboulettes, where I've had a good meal recently.
Mm.
And very nice people.
Cool.
There's one other question. Someone had called and left a question that we need to get to because it was a little while ago.
Sure.
Michelle in Baltimore, looking for ideas to make a special birthday meal for sister, has to practice autoimmune protocol, no wheat, no dairy, no eggs, no nightshades.
Okay. So I think, you know, with that, I would just go towards fish. You know, let's be as healthy as possible. And, you know, maybe a fish like rockfish or red snapper.
How about a seafood risotto?
Oh, okay.
Because there's no
okay.
dairy.
Yeah.
There's no gluten.
Right.
There's
right.
no eggs.
And that's nice
there's
because
a lot
then
of
she
happiness.
Can have, then she can have, you know, something that feels like it's gluten, but it's not. And yeah, and make a beautiful seafood stock. You could make it with shrimp. Maybe little neck clams and mussels, and what can happen is you steam open that seafood, it will start to impart flavor into the risotto. Also with shrimp, you can make a very, very quick little shrimp stock, which could be the foundation of the liquid that you add to the rice as you're making it. So when I peel and devein my shrimp and take the shells off, I just rinse them quickly and then put them in a pot with water to cover, bring it up to a boil, and turn it off and strain it. And that is simple as heck, and it gives you a wonderful, light, pretty little stock to make risotto with. And, yeah, just a little onion shallot and add your seafood, whatever you would like. And you could even do a shellfish risotto and then serve it with a piece of fish. That might be fun.
If you want a pretty good, quick guide, God rest him, Giuliano Bugiali, who just passed away, he is really masterful work. On basic Italian technique, and his is excellent.
His books are fantastic. Yes, I didn't know he passed away.
So should people come and visit you guys?
we would love that, and it actually gets back to one of the first questions on the show, which was how do you learn more about wine? Hmm. And one of the best ways is to actually go where wine is made and see the vineyard, meet the people.
Absolutely.
And yes, obviously. Come to Sonoma County, come to Russian River, come to Dehlinger.
Good.
Well,
good.
Eva, thanks so much for being on the program.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So nice to meet you.
I think that's all we have time for. If you want to download, if you missed some of this and you want to download it or any of the other podcasts, you can go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look up the Former Wolf page. We'll also post Dehlinger's information if you want to check out a link there. Not now, in just a few minutes. And see what the winery is all about. And if you want to reach us, email us, formerwolf@wypr.org. If you want to follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me on Twitter as Chef Cindy Wolf and on Instagram as Chef Wolf.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. And it's lovely outside. Have a great Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Happy Sunday.